Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction, and thanks to David and Adrienne, wherever you are, David, for inviting me to come here to KITP. I have to admit that this is somewhat unfamiliar ground for me. I don't recognize anybody. This is one of the first conferences where I recognize only 5% of the science and 0% of the attendance. But still, I hope that we'll find common ground.
It's a cultural experience.
It's a cultural experience. I have to say, also the way how you went after each other, it was nice to witness theorists going after each other. I mean, I hope my talk didn't prevent you from going all the way, folding chairs and all of that. Now somebody may hear me back at the end of my discussion. Anyway, so as Fred mentioned, I'm actually a synthetic organic chemist by training, but I had some earlier exposure during my studies in neuroscience, and while about half of my group is still concerned with synthesizing beautiful molecules, natural products, the other half is now doing what we like to call receptor reprogramming, where we re-educate, so to speak, ancient receptors, especially in neuroscience, to become sensitive towards unnatural input signals, such as light, perhaps magnetism, orthogonal neurotransmitters, you name it, and then we put them back into fairly complex systems to see what these receptors do. And the systems, of course, which we are concerned with are neural systems. In particular, I should say the retina, because from my perspective, there's one tissue where I certainly hope to understand it to a certain level during my lifetime. It's perhaps the retina. And therefore, we have been always fascinated with this beautiful molecular machine, rhodopsin, very small organic switch, so to speak, is attached to a protein and then controls through some form of photoisomerization the function of this protein. And really seen as a molecular machine which you can perhaps take apart and then soup up, right, and endow it with new functional properties and put it back and then put it into systems. And the question which we asked is, could we perhaps take just about any synthetic switch, chemical switch, and attach it to just about any... Oh, sorry, I forgot that. My voice carries, I think, but you need
it's
to record.
For the recording.
Yeah, then. Okay, thanks. Then. And could we take just about any chemical switch and attach it to just about any protein to control the function of this protein with a switch? Perhaps most interestingly with a switch which is responsive to light. And here are the proteins which we have worked on so far. As you see, this is a fairly wide class of receptors. I will tell you today a little bit, mostly actually, about ionotropic glutamate receptors and our efforts in collaboration with Udi Isakov to sensitize them towards light, to turn an IGLOR into a LIGLOR, into a light-gated ionotropic glutamate receptor. But we've also done work together with Rich Kramer mostly on voltage-gated potassium channels, which are amenable to the same approach. And most recently, we've actually started to work on GPCRs, family A and family C GPCRs, all of which, of course, and that for us as chemists was absolutely crucial, are now more or less known in the full three-dimensional glory to these wonderful crystal structures by Rob McKinnon and Ray Stevens and Eric Goh and others. That really, and from our perspective, sort of opened the floodgates and allowed us to surf that wave of structural knowledge and to do the kind of manipulation which I've alluded to before. So let me go back to this, from a structural to a more conceptual level and talk a little bit how we think about endowing receptors with sensitivity towards light. When you think about a native receptor, it doesn't have to be a clamshell-like receptor, just about any binding site can be imagined. It binds to a ligand, and that then leads to a biological effect, triggers a biological effect, and this is abrogated by the ligand, or ligand as you say in biology, diffusing away. I say ligand, you say ligand, there's probably a song about that. Really, there is another cultural difference between chemists and biologists that use a ligand. In any case, yeah. So how can you now bring in photo sensitivity? And the most manual approach, hugely successful in neuroscience, of course, is to cage the ligand, as biologists would say, chemists would say, the ligand is attached to a photocleavable protecting group, which you can sub off with light and then release the ligand. It becomes efficacious, then triggers the biological effect. And that is beautiful. As you know, nobody would argue that caged glutamate has not been hugely successful in neuroscience. But it has certain functional shortcomings, such as, for instance, that this is a unidirectional effect. You can only go into this direction, but you cannot stuff the beast back into the cage, so to speak, right? And then you accumulate byproducts, which might be toxic. There are certain functional issues which make this less than perfect. which is what prompted us to think more about an approach that we call the photochromic ligand approach, a PCL approach, where the ligand now is endowed with a side chain that contains a molecular photoswitch. A molecular photoswitch which in one form, like the cis form indicated here, turns this construct, this molecule, not efficacious, can reach its binding site, it cannot trigger the biological effect. But if you photoisomerize, symbolized here, then suddenly it becomes efficacious and biology takes place. And the beauty of this is that this is reversible. You can switch back and forth with light, for instance, this switch to turn this into a light-controlled effect.
Do you reapply to different wavelengths?
You have to reapply to different wavelengths, or you have a photo switch which has a default state that it turns into thermally so quickly that it operates on a neuroscientific timescale. And I will show you a neurobiological timescale. I show you examples for that. So it either is H-NU2 or it is KBT. It also can itself turn off thermally if you design the system properly. And you will see an example at the very end of my talk for that. Okay. And that is nice, but it has also certain shortcomings, namely the shortcomings of pharmacology. It's sometimes very difficult to design a molecule which is completely inactive, not even an antagonist in one form, and fully active in the other form. In addition to this, you have to deal with photostationary states. Photoswitches are typically never fully bistable, so you always have to deal with 95.5 cis to trans at given wavelength, for instance. And that kind of seemingly limits the system. But as you will see later on, I hope I'll be able to convince you, in a neural system, this is actually not a big problem. You just have to push a system a little bit towards the other end of the spectrum, and you can then, due to the power of the action potential, get very, very clean readouts, even if the photostationary states are rather poor. But the biggest disadvantage of this system is perhaps that it's not genetically encodable. Right? This is a pharmacology approach, so there is no genetics involved. And that has prompted us to think even more about what we like to call the photoswitch-tethered ligand approach, PTL approach, where the ligand is now literally tethered chemically, covalently, to the surface of the receptor of the active site with some form of bioconjugation that you can genetically encode. In the simplest case, this is just the cysteine, which we then attach a maleimide photoswitch to. You will see this later on as well. And then it's covalently attached. The photoswitch is now in the tethering element and holds the ligand in one form of the photoswitch, the transform, for instance, at arm's length. But if you photoisomerize to the cis form, it can reach the binding site and then trigger the biological effect. And again, this is reversible. You, in effect, change the effective concentration of the ligand with light. That's all you really do. And it is genetically encodable through the bioconjugation, which you can put in some form, as I said already, in the simplest form by way of a cysteine. And let me show you how this pans out on the ionotropic glutamate receptor. This is a very simple, agreed, a very simple conceptual picture of the ionotropic glutamate receptor, which, as you know, has this clamshell-like extracellular ligand binding domains. The neurotransmitter comes along, glutamate binds to the clamshell closes, and this is somewhat somehow mechanically coupled to the opening of a pore through which the sodium potassium flow. The overall effect is depolarizing, and our idea was that if you put this then in an excitable cell, which has the machinery of action potential generation, of course, you would trigger that way an action potential. I don't have to tell you this. But what we have done now is to tether glutamate to the surface of the clamshell-like ligand binding domain through a tether that can be shortened or lengthened with light. And as we photoisomerize, we can now turn what used to be a ligand-gated ion channel into a light-gated ion channel. It's that simple, seemingly. Right? The devil, however, as always, lies in the details. I will not get into the details of designing this system, because there are many things you have to worry about. You have to worry about how to derivatize glutamate itself in such a way that it still functions when tethered as an agonist, not as an antagonist, or not being inactive. Is there an exit tunnel, for instance? That was one of the questions we asked ourselves as chemists, through which we could thread such a photo switch endowed tether. The short answer is yes, there is one, and we wouldn't have found it probably without these beautiful crystal structures, mostly by Eric Goh really, and Mark Meyer have led the way there and have allowed us to design such a system as chemists and to synthesize the appropriate chemicals. I will also not show you the synthesis. We spend about 80% of our time with synthesis. It's a wonderful craft. don't ever underestimate the sophistication which goes into that, but of course it would be hard to convey here. And this is the molecule which we wound up with, a molecule which we call MAG, for maleimide azobenzene glutamate. The maleimide is there, as I already said, for bioconjugation. So you put in, you genetically engineer a cysteine into the appropriate position with some form of transfection, and that cysteine attaches itself then to the maleimide. In the middle, we have this azobenzene molecule, which functions as the photoswitch. This is invariably our favorite photoswitch. One of the reasons is that it undergoes this huge change in geometry between the transform, which predominates in the dark. This is the dark adapted state, the thermodynamically more stable state, and the cis form, which predominates at 380 nanometers. So at UVA, you have about 95% of cis azobenzene content, whereas in the dark, if you wait long enough, or if you push it at 500 nanometers, when you turn on 500 nanometers light, it reverts to the long form. This is the switchable element that lengthens and shortens the tether. And at the other end of this construct, we have our glutamate derivative, which has a specific stereochemistry, a specific configuration here that could be deduced from the crystal structures.
Is this an entirely synthetic thing, or is that used in biology?
That's entirely synthetic. You need a synthetic chemist like myself to make it, but you can make grams of it if you need to, right? So.
And it didn't come from some biological.
No, it didn't come from some. There is no, as I, not as far as I know, there is an azobenzene photoswitch used in biology, the naturally occurring azobenzene photoswitch. There are naturally occurring azobenzenes, but they have no biological function I'm aware of. And so this is a completely synthetic design system, which we then attach to the natural protein to make a hybrid photoreceptor, bionic machine, whatever you want to call it, right? So this is the synthetic part of it. And that, of course, turns this into a two-component system, because this is not made by your worm or by your fly or by your mouse. You have to add it. But as you will see, this is not necessarily a limitation. It does work.
So with unmodified protein, if I eat a gram, does it have an action on...
Yes, I think it would. I think it would, because it would... Well, it certainly would find it would act as a glutamatergic neurotransmitter, right? But it would not covalently modify at a sufficient rate the natural receptor. So you need that cysteine for this bioconjugation to take place. Unless you happen to have a cysteine, which you don't, in
so
all the glutamate receptors.
Without cysteine, I can eat tons of this and...
Well, you might get a stroke, right? Because it might be an excitotoxin, but but I wouldn't recommend eating tons of it. And I won't make that much, but I would say that you would not have a specific effect. Uh-huh. But as you will see, we give this, we feed this to our fish, and they eat it, and it gets into the neurons. It express that transgene, which has the cysteine in the appropriate position, and then attaches itself to it.
Which receptor are you putting the cysteine
on? Mostly on kinin receptor.
Huh?
So far, mostly kinin receptors, GluA6 specifically, or GluK2 as it's called now. We are working on the AMPA receptor version, and we have already, as of yet unpublished work, done the corresponding work on NMDA receptors.
How does it get through the blood-brain barrier?
I think it's pumped because it's a glutamate derivative. To be honest, I was extremely surprised that this works, a little DMSO sometimes helps, right? But so far in fish, as you will see, it works beautifully. One of the ways to answer your question, this molecule has a certain very faint resemblance to kinic acid and to tomoic acid, which are also glutamate derivatives. And they do get into the brain, right, in the central nervous system. This is what people poison themselves with when they eat fish that have taken up the diatomies that make kinic acid and tomoic acid. I mean, you work with kinic acid every day, right? And this is a natural product which does make its way into the blood-brain, through the blood-brain barrier, although it is not glutamate itself. It's a version of glutamate. And there's a certain resemblance of that with kinic acid.
Can you just give us a sense of how strong the light would have to be, like what kind of light sources would work in brain light?
I would say regular outdoors daylight works. And it doesn't have to be very intense. The photoswitches have a very high quantum yield. Typically, and what was it? It was about I forgot now what the actual intensity was, but it corresponds to not bright daylight, to ambient daylight.
You could do this with LEDs.
So it's something in the range of 20 milliwatt per square centimeter. You can do this with LED beautifully. You don't need a laser for that. And it actually, a handheld UV lamp you have in a chemistry laboratory does the job, which has a 380 nanometer channel, a 365 nanometer channel. So the photo switching is actually not the problem. The photo switching itself is extremely fast. We have measured this with time-resolved spectroscopy. This takes place within 1 picosecond. This is an extremely fast process. And then the proton has to take soot, and has to follow soot. And as you will see, this pans out beautifully on a time scale, which is neurobiologically relevant. So we can do this with up to 60 hertz without problems. And without bleaching as well. This is another advantage of these azobenzenes, that they're very robust. They do very little intersystem crossing, so you don't mix in with oxygen. It's one of the issues you often have with photo switches, that you have intersystem crossing, and that usually leads to the toxic effects of single oxygen. Okay, and just very briefly, I want to mention that we also mutate our molecules as synthetic chemists. We usually make a small library with different length and stiffness, and that we can combine, we can match, we can mix and match with different points of attachment. So these are the positions, the cysteine mutants, which have been actually explored or made by the Isakov laboratory, the Paugoros DISA. It turns out that this position in system 439 with our first photo switch, MAG1, which I showed you initially, was already hit. This was the second combination which we tried, and it works beautifully. This is, by the way, the crystal structure of the full-fledged AMPA receptor by Eric Goh, with the clamshell blown up here, so to speak. And as you can see here from a patch clamp experiment in hex cells, this works actually quite well. Let's look at the right side. This is current over time. Underneath the wavelength, you radiate the cell with over time. And we look at the right side as you go between 380 nanometers and 500 nanometers. You see these nice inward currents, which are pinched off when you go to 500 nanometers. And you don't only have this analog effect of on-off, you also have an analog effect because in this ensemble of channels, the photostationary states of the azobenzene molecules are reflected, as shown here, at 380 nanometers. We have maximum cis-azobenzene, you also have maximum current, whereas at 400 or 360 nanometers, you have less current reflecting the photostationary states. That's sort of a hypothetical curve, but that's about what it looks like of azobenzene molecules. That means you can actually determine the amount of current you inject into the cell with the color of the light you radiate your system with. That's one functional aspect which the channel adopts.
And the receptors don't desensitize.
In that case, they don't desensitize because there's concaina valine. But in the neurons, they don't. And to be honest, we don't fully understand this. This has never been an issue, as you can see here. This is now LIGLOR, our light-gated glutamate receptor, in an excitable neuron, an excitable cell, a neuron. It's an embryonic red hippocampal neuron. And as we go between 380 nanometers and 500 nanometers, we can trigger these bursts, these strains of action potentials, which we can turn off very quickly by going to the other wavelength to 500 nanometers. And that is quite reliable, doesn't miss a beat, so to speak. At 20 hertz, we don't miss an action potential. At 30 hertz, we don't. At 50 hertz, we don't in these hippocampal neurons. At 100 hertz, we depolarize, repolarize reliably, but we don't spike. That's probably a limitation of the very neuron we're using, right? Because embryonic hippocampal neurons are not firing at this rate. I'm pretty sure if we did this in some auditory neuron, we would have the same effect at 100 hertz.
So in slices?
You will see. Okay, it works in slices, it works in animals, it works in a lot of systems. Okay, so this is so far data in dissociated neurons. Let me go back very briefly to a more conceptual level. One of the things I like about these hybrid nanomachines is that they're so incredibly tunable, right? You can tune, of course, channel adoptions as well, and you've all seen CHEDAR and other systems, how beautifully they work, but you are confined to the genetic code to do that. And we don't only have that, but we can also play with the chemistry and with many other aspects of our protein, for instance. So one of the things which I always enjoy in neuroscience is the ease with which you can invert the sign, right? We call this Umpolung as chemists, sign inversion. So when you attach our construct, the shortest one actually, at this position here, 439C, then indeed it is active in the cis form, in other words, at 380 nanometers. If, however, you move the point of attachment just a few angstroms, it seems, in this static picture, to a different position in the upper valve of the clamshell, to 486C, then suddenly the transform becomes the active one. In other words, the channel is active at green light at 500 nanometers and not at 80 nanometers. Uri calls this the yin-yang system, so to speak. In this case, you activate your spike with 80 nanometers with 439C with the same molecule, by the way. So you can have two different genes in your slice, so to speak, and one molecule. Whereas if you attach it to 486C, then it spikes it, it triggers an action potential at 500 nanometers. It's published a while ago.
How do you control the attachment site?
Through genetics. So by putting in either the 439C mutant with some form of transfection, or the 486C mutant with some form of transfection, or transgenic animal into your neuron of choice, of interest. Another case for sign inversion, for umpolung, which I find quite attractive, was actually developed by Harald Janowiak, a postdoc in Uri's lab, who is now with me in Munich. And Harald came up with this idea to screw our light-gating module, so to speak, of a kinate receptor of GluR6 onto the transmembrane domain of a bacterial glutamate receptor, or a prokaryotic glutamate receptor, GluR0, which is actually potassium-selective. And that, of course, turns this into a hyperpolarizing channel instead of a depolarizing channel when you do the light triggering now. And that's exactly what you see. It was published earlier this year in Nature Neuroscience. You depolarize, you trigger action potentials, you open our channel, you silence the neuron, you close our channel, it keeps firing again. So in other words, we have not only a light-gated depolarizing ion channel based on the glutamate receptor, but also a light-gated hyperpolarizing ion channel based on the glutamate receptor. And as you will see, we can do the same thing based on potassium channels as well. And here now some movies of a rather coarse system which show that this does work in zebrafish. As you probably all know, zebrafish has a touch response. Some reflex circuitry is triggered when you touch it with a pipette as a larva. It zips away. And we have endowed the zebrafish with LIGLOR, which was expressed pretty coarsely across the nervous system. The net effect is that we more or less short-circuit this reflex circuitry. As the zebrafish is touched, the zebrafish larva is touched, it flips its little fins. I hope you can see this here. But you don't have the vertebral response anymore, which makes it swim away. At 80 nanometers, and we irradiate the same zebrafish. Look at the schmutz here to convince yourself that this is the same zebrafish. With 500 nanometers, we restore the normal reflex circuitry. If you touch it now, it zips away as it should. And this is reversible. Of course, it's tough to find the same zebrafish again, but you can. You neuroscientists, you're a creative bunch. You stick them into agar, right? And then you can do this in a more fixated version. A question. Somebody had a question.
I think you were telling me. So this is which potassium channels or a bunch of it?
The glutamate receptors.
One that you showed for the potassium channel, though.
That was GluR0. This is actually not a potassium channel. It is a potassium channel, but it is a prokaryotic glutamate receptor, which is potassium selective.
Okay.
So it's not an unselective.
So you don't have one that we could just put in and put on like the potassium channels that are already there. Right?
We can do that. I will show you that in a minute.
Oh.
So this is actually the very first system. But you can also re-educate the glutamate receptor to become a potassium channel, a light-gated potassium channel, by using the prokaryotic version, which was also actually discovered by Eric Goh, GluR0, that is potassium selective and not non-selective cationic.
Does the presence of your construct interfere with the normal form?
Apparently not. I'm not an expert in zebrafish behavior. I should have mentioned that this was done in collaboration with Herwig Bayer, who then also made the Gal4 lines to do this, as you will see, in a much more selective fashion. This is a paper where this was done in a much more targeted and selective fashion. And they were actually able to target LIGLOR onto a so-called Kolmar-Arctur neuron, which apparently plays a major role in invertebrate locomotion, or the role of which was discovered by endowing it with LIGLOR. And from what Herwig tells me, the fish don't behave unnaturally, and actually when they reach adulthood, long after our photoswitches are gone, they're still normal. So they do reach adulthood normally.
And synaptically, the least glutamates is uninteresting to these
So this glide-gated channel is, first of all, engineered in a way that it's less sensitive towards synaptically released glutamate. So it already has a decreased affinity, EC50, towards synaptically released glutamate. And apparently, in this system, we can overwhelm the still expressed natural glutamate receptors with our modified ones. The modification of which, of course, is only a single cysteine. So that still functions as a normal glutamate receptor. This is, before you attach the photoswitch, it behaves as a regular kinate receptor. It's overexpressed, so there's more of it than there would be normally, but it is not. It is still functional. It also responds to the natural neural.
Then kind of glutamatergic synapses or inhibitory contact.
Well, this is sorry. I should have mentioned. This is back to IGLOR. This is not IGLOR. This is not highlighter, as we call it, the potassium selective. This is, I should have said this. This is the back to the excitatory system. This is back to the regular light gated ionotropic glutamate receptor, kinase receptor. Okay, that was expressed here. So this is our good old IGLOR, which was used in this paper to identify the role of Comarc to neurons in vertebrate locomotion. However, as I've already mentioned, from my perspective, the retina is a little bit more easy to understand, arguably more easy to understand than zebrafish behavior. And what we are quite excited about is the possibility to use these light-gated, these artificial photoreceptors in vision restoration. Right? As you know, in macular degeneration, the photosensitive layer of the retina, the photoreceptor layer, is more or less destroyed. Rods and cones are gone. But the remainder of the circuitry is still largely intact, even years after people turn blind from macular degeneration or from retinitis pigmentosa. And there is an opportunity to hijack all these receptors. Glutamate receptors, of course, are expressed everywhere, but also, let's say, TRP channels, or dopamine receptors, or voltage-gated potassium channels, which also they are everywhere. Or, what else do we have? Glycine receptors, and turn them into photoreceptors. We have done this in collaboration with Udi Isakov and with John Flannery in Berkeley at the level of retinal ganglion cells, where the LIGLOR gene, the cysteine mutant, was delivered to the retinal ganglion cell with adeno-associated viruses. The transfection efficiency is apparently extremely good. You get essentially quantitative transfection of retinal ganglion cells with LIGLOR. And one of the advantages of retinal ganglion cells, of course, is that they sit on the top of the retina, where they are not only first hit with light, but also first hit with chemicals, such as our MAG molecule, and with viruses. So this is one of the beauties. And of course, in the retina, you don't have to worry how to get the light in. And this is the result. This is now a multi-electrode array recording from a retina of an RDE1 mouse. And as you see, this mouse has some restored vision at the retinal level. It's a switch between 500 nanometers and 380 nanometers. We see this burst of activity at 380 nanometers, which is when the LIGLOR channels are active and cells, retinal ganglion cells, are depolarized and start firing. But we don't only see this at the level of the retina in the form of a multi-electrode array recording, but also in the visual cortex. This is actually a recording of an evoked visual potential in the visual cortex of a blind RD1 mouse. This is the eye which has not been manipulated, where LIGLOR has not been expressed, the compound has not been delivered. As you see, this mouse is blind. It's a live mouse. As you switch between 500 nanometers and 380 nanometers, you see no response. Whereas this is the eye where LIGLOR has been virally delivered with an adeno-associated virus, and our compound has been added. And you see this nice response to 380 nanometers, which is actually pretty similar to the response you have in a wild-type mouse.
Would there be a way of checking for behavior, something that would give you some information about what is the percept that they
are? There is a way. There are maze studies which are actually in the forthcoming paper. There's a paper submitted which is about to be accepted. I can talk about this. And there is actually a light aversion behavior. This is something I have learned, that mice don't like light, and you can build essentially a water maze, which shows that they do perceive light again. This is, of course, a very coarse form of vision at this stage.
This is just light versus dark.
This is light versus dark. But, you know, I have...
A stimulation that is agreed this way versus this way and making choose in a binary task depending on the stimulus.
I'm sure this is something which Udi and John Flannery are thinking very hard about. I've been told that mice are not very remarkable for their visual acuity and for their visual behavior, and they're actually pretty boring in terms of vision. And it would be better to do this with a bald-headed eagle, the genetics of which is somewhat underdeveloped. But there is clearly a desire to do this. We actually are a little bit higher with respect
to the reason I'm asking has system. To do with what is the code. So you are stimulating the retinal ganglion cells. You are bypassing.
Which I agree, it's very low. It's very low in the hierarchy.
Bypassing the whole machinery, of course, within the retina. Receptors. And the question is, could you spatial temporally modulate the input? And would there be a way to check whether the animal's first visual percept?
I'm not an expert of mouse behavior. I guess there might be regimes to do this. I mean, Botan Roska has recently put general dopsin in sort of remainders of cones, I think it was, and has, together with my colleague Martin Biel in Munich, was able to show some pretty sophisticated behavior. I agree. It would be better to put this higher up in the system. And as you will see later on, we actually have a photo switch which seems to target mostly amacrine cells. They're a little bit higher up already. But even if it only works at the level of retinal ganglion cells, you know, you can always argue that the difference between an open door and a closed door is an improvement in quality of life. And I would argue that we can get probably about as good as retinal implants. I mean, this is pretty much mimicking retinal implants, which target retinal ganglion cells, right? And from what I've seen, what I've heard, people who have retinal implants, where you essentially add a microchip on top of the retinal ganglion cell layer to electrically stimulate them, they can distinguish between an orange and a banana, and they see if somebody talks with them, and they can go through a door. And we hope that this is the level we could achieve with this system as well. But there might be...
In the retinal chip, too, they take very little account of what we know about neural coding in the retina. It's just pulses.
Very little.
No, I agree, it's coarse, but it's perhaps a less invasive alternative to the retinal implants, to the retinal chips.
So what about light intensities? People have to carry a UV laser with them to use this? Or?
Getting there. This is where the chemists come in again, because chemists are good at shifting action spectra and at redesigning molecules to address this question. This is one of the limitations we have, of course, at the moment, that we are dealing with 380 nanometers and 500 nanometers. Ophthalmologists hate 380 nanometers. This is UVA, right? There's a lot of it around in sunlight, by the way, as you know, because you get tanned, right? So this is more UVB. And this is a wavelength where mice, by the way, see, right? I've been told that mice see at 380 nanometers. And of course, bees and insects see at 380 nanometers. So this is not necessarily a wavelength which is against life and which is cytotoxic, right? I mean, there are many animals which see at 380 nanometers. This is just 20 nanometers away from deep violet. Right? And in fact, I should also mention, there's another answer to your question, that deep violet does the same. So 400 nanometers for 20 nanometers does the same job. We see with the photo switches I'll show you later on at 400 nanometers also considerable effects. But still, deep blue, deep violet is not so good for the retina, I've been told. And there is a desire which we as chemists answer to redshift the whole system. And you will see at the very end of my talk an example for that. But let me go back a little bit to the conceptual level and talk about the breadth, so to speak, the range of this approach, because it's not confined to ion channels. It's also not confined to clamshell containing receptors, although there are a lot of clamshell containing receptors, such as family C G protein coupled receptors, which are of course represented by the metabotropic glutamate receptors. These are G protein coupled receptors that have an extracellular a clamshell with which you could play the same game. Taste receptors, pheromone receptors, GABA B receptors fall into this rather large and neurobiologically important class of receptors. And you could do the same thing. You could tether glutamate or something resembling glutamate to the surface of this clamshell and trigger closure and the associated biological effect with light, and I'm happy to report that we have been able to do this again based on crystal structures. I don't think this would have been easily possible without the work by Shingami, who has actually crystallized the extracellular clamshells of metabotopic glutamate receptors, which, by the way, don't look very much like the clamshells of ionotopic glutamate receptors. They actually look more like the N-terminal domain clamshells of ionotopic glutamate receptors. And then we can play the same game. The only difference, the only change we had to make in the molecule is we had to invert the stereochemistry here. That was based on the crystal structure analysis. And we see this, right? These are unpublished preliminary data on the photocontrol of mGlu2 in that case. In HEC cells, we actually use a GERP channel readout. So you see, again, electrophysiology to, we can also do this with calcium imaging, of course. And as we go between 380 nanometers and 500 nanometers, you see these rise responses, which are about 60% of saturating glutamate and have the appropriate kinetics. So I think we can claim that we have re-educated a GPCR, a G-protein coupled receptor, a metabotropic glutamate receptor to become a photoreceptor. The system is even broader. We have already put choline on a string, so we can photocontrol acetylcholine receptors, nicotinic acetylcholine receptors with the same logic with a choline on a string. We've put morphine on a string. We haven't done this yet. We haven't done the receptor physiology yet. But since I did, as you mentioned, a total synthesis of morphine as a grad student, I couldn't resist doing this as well. We've put maltose on the string. We have a photo switchable version of dopamine. We have a photo switchable version of a benzodiazepine. Tell me your favorite receptor, and I can think about turning it into a photoreceptor.
So if you put like dopamine or something on a string and put it in an animal, will the dopamine get metabolized, or does it hang around? I mean,
you probably would have to make a chemical version of dopamine which does not easily get metabolized. So you would have to make something resembling salbutamol, right? I mean, the problem with dopamine metabolism is that dopamine, little chemistry, is a catechol, right? And catechols are very unstable. But if you replace this catechol with this function here, as it is done in salbutamol and other, this is actually a beta-adrenergic receptor, but it's the same targeting compound, but it's the same logic, then you can actually stabilize this. I mean, you know, I should mention that we don't only profit from the crystal structures, but of course also from the huge body of pharmacology, which is usually available for all of these receptors. So there are lots of dopamine receptor agonists which don't have a catechol version, which are metabolically much more stable than, let's say, apomorphine or dopamine itself. That's the power of chemistry, that you can overcome these limitations of naturally occurring ligands. So this is a summary of what we have done so far. I've mostly talked about the PTL approach applied to glutamate receptors. What about the PCL approach, the photochromic ligand approach applied to glutamate receptors, where the ligand is now not covalently attached to the surface, foregoing this ability to genetically encode it. But of course, in terms of therapy, this is much more attractive because you don't have to do any gene therapy before you add the molecule, right? And we call this an exercise in photopharmacology. And a while ago, we've actually published this molecule here, a photochromic ligand for kinate receptors, an azobenzene derivative, which is a good agonist for mostly GluR5, but also GluR6 in the trans form, but becomes a bad agonist in the cis form. And that is nothing else but a reversibly caged glutamate. This is a glutamate which changes its efficacy upon irradiation, right? And indeed, when you wash this on and then you radiate it with UV light, you turn off the effect of the neurotransmitter when you go back to 500 nanometers or wait long enough that it thermally reverts. In that case, the thermal reversion takes minutes, by the way. You can trigger action potentials. And I published this in JAX in 2007. This is a pretty reputable journal for a chemist, the Journal of the American Chemical Society. I didn't get a single phone call from a biologist, which I blamed on the fact that they published it in JAX, and none of you reads JAX, right? I can understand why, but of course, if you had read it, you would also have not called me, because you would have noticed that there's a functional flaw, the functional flaw being that this is an excitotoxin, right, in the dark adapted state. So in the default state, in the dark adapted state, this thing functions like an excitotoxin, and there's not that much interesting experiments you can do with it, which is why I'm happy to report that recently we've actually synthesized a molecule which doesn't have this problem, which we call ATG, This molecule functions as an agonist in the cis form at 370 nanometers, whereas its function is silent in the trans form. If you wash this on, this is now slice work from Munich. These are layer 2-3 cortical neurons, which we investigated in my lab. You wash it on, it doesn't do anything. You go to, hard to see, you go to 370 nanometers, you trigger trains of action potentials. And it turns out that this molecule actually is an agonist for NMDA receptors. This is a photochromic agonist for NMDA receptors, as shown here by this pharmacology slide. When we wash on AP5, you can actually turn off the effect of this compound. But the overall effect is that you can control firing in cortical layer 2-3 neurons. This is ridiculous that I show you this, but I'm so proud that as a chemist I have this in my lab, right? I mean, we literally 5 meters from here, this is where the glove box is and where the separatory funnels are, and then my students walk over there and investigate this compound. I have a neuroscientist coming from Arthur Connor's lab, I should say, in my group as a permanent group member, and you see as we switch between 380 and 500 nanometers, we trigger bursts of action potentials with this compound. So I'm throwing this out. One of the issues I always have is that we make these tools and I don't really know what they're good for, but if you have an idea how you could use a photochromic NMDA receptor agonist, which turns on when you irradiate your slice with 370 nanometers and turns off if you irradiate with 500 nanometers, talk with me, I'd be happy to give this out. I have a feeling, a gut feeling, that this could be a useful device. Also because you can, for instance, impose a certain frequency, a certain rhythm onto your neural network. That's one of the advantages of these photo switches, that you can pack them, right? You can say, I want to flip my photo switch with 50 hertz, and then see what happens. All right, now let's talk briefly about voltage-gated ion channels.
The VCN, if it's not bound, how do you control that it stays there? Doesn't it escape?
It will come off, right? I mean, in one form, it will bind. In the other form, it will come off. Whether this is just passive diffusion or whether it's literally bounced off because you exert force upon photo switching is a matter of debate. This is something which we're currently trying to figure out, whether the molecule first has to come off with the usual off rate and then photoisomerizes, or whether the photoisomerization takes place when bound to the binding site. But it doesn't come off very fast. The one I showed you before takes more than 100 milliseconds to actually come off. So this is a second time scale.
This is, I think, well, not exactly related, but how stably do these whole molecules attach to these receptors so that if you then put it on and then lower the concentration around the tissue, will they stay there or do they then come off?
They will come off. I mean, they're just pharmaca. They typically are less efficacious than glutamate itself. So a saturated concentration is maybe 500 micromolar. That one we haven't titrated yet, but I have a feeling that the EC50 is in that is going to be around that range. But this is, you know, this is like AMPA. AMPA is also a synthetic compound, right? And you can use it. And this is like a photoswitchable version of NMDA in that case. It's also a synthetic compound, not a natural compound. And we can play with the pharmacology. We're currently getting close to making a similar version which would selectively target an AMPA receptor. So GLUA2 in that case. As always with pharmacology, if you work hard enough, you might find one which is actually highly selective. But of course, it's also sometimes frustrating pharmacology. For instance, it took us a while to figure out that this compound targets NMDA receptors, because little did I know that CNQX also targets the NR2A subunit of NMDA receptors. I thought CNQX is a selective antagonist of AMPA receptors, but it actually also targets NMDA receptors by way of their NR2A subunit. Anyway, so agreed, pharmacology has limitations, but as you will see later on when I talk about the photoswitchable version of lidocaine, which is probably the dirtiest drug under the sun, but it's still used when you go to the dentist, it also is simple to use, right, this non-tethered version. But let me talk briefly about voltage-gated ion channels. You may say, how am I going to apply this concept to voltage-gated ion channels, because there is no ligand to play with, right, to play the PTL-PCL game with. We see them as sophisticated molecular machines, this sort of cases A of Rod McKeon has a certain resemblance with a sophisticated machine, with a jet engine. And how do you manipulate a sophisticated machine? Very simply, you let a bird fly into it, right? And that's exactly what nature does, right? Nature has been incredibly creative with evolving little birds, Akitoxin 2, Calliotoxin, Dendrotoxin, you name it, which do nothing else than blocking voltage-gated potassium channels mostly. And typically are little mini proteins which have a lysine side chain sticking out of this antiparallel beta sheet. And this lysine literally plugs the pore. These are made by green mamba, tarantula, death stalker, scorpion, you name it. Think of your favorite toxic animal, you bet it actually makes these things. This is almost a universal principle, because you can kill or immobilize the prey and then you can eat it afterwards, right? Because you can digest these things. So it's pretty logical to use this. And chemists have been able to dumb this down all the way to tetraethyl ammonium, right? That's what tetraethyl ammonium does too. Classical Huxley-Hodgkin's tetraethyl ammonium, which has, as you know, two binding sites, one on the inside and one on the outside, it turns out. Also has a binding site in the interstellar lumen. And that allows us to play the same games again we've played before. I'm actually not aware that anybody has ever made a caged version of a potassium channel blocker. I don't think it's that interesting to make this. But we have made, together with Rich Kramer many years ago, the photoswitch tethered ligand version of it, where we literally tethered TA through an azobenzene photoswitch to the surface of a channel. And that, by the way, was the first light-gated ion channel that could control firing in neurons. That was in 2004. And when we published this, I thought this is wonderful, because A, I get tenure in Berkeley, and B, which I did, and B, the neuroscientists are going to sleep on my doorstep, right, to get some of that good stuff. And then half a year later, channel adoptions came on the scene and we were completely wiped out. Right? It's a case of, how did Goethe say this, the better is the enemy of the good, right? And it's true, right? I mean, this is history almost now, but although there's still this ability to genetically encode it. This is why I want to focus today on the PCL version of it, because I think this is still competitive because it's so simple to use. This is a compound that functions as a photoswitchable blocker of potassium channels, actually of just about any tetrameric voltage or pseudo-tetrameric voltage-gated ion channel, also sodium channels, calcium channels, by way of blocking the inner lumen of the channel in a photoswitchable version. These are compounds that you just apply from the outside. One version of them is amphiphilic, so it has a positive charge. It's a tetraethyl ammonium with an azobenzene tail. You just drop it on your network of choice, and like lidocaine, which it actually resembles chemically, it goes in, blocks the inner lumen of the channel in the trans form. When you photoisomerize it to the cis form, it allows conductance. And you can switch this back and forth. And here is a recording from an embryonic hippocampal neuron. You just add the compound, you switch to 500 nanometers. It blocks the potassium channel, which lifts hyperpolarization. Then you switch to 380 nanometers. It opens the potassium channels into hyperpolarize and silence the neurons in a rather reliable fashion. All you need to do is you throw this compound, which is, by the way, super cheap, very cheap to make. I can make, in this case, I can really make a kilo of it if needed. Onto the neuron of choice. And this has been done by Rich Kramer and in collaboration with Tom Odis and Bill Christen at UCSD, in different systems. We had a Nature Methods paper quite a while ago where we showed that this works in Purkinje neurons. We actually showed that we really photo control basket neurons, which are inhibitory neurons, talking to Purkinje neurons. By the way, this is something I learned today. What is the what do you guys use as graphical representation of inhibitory and excitatory connection? Excitatory apparently is this.
No, the other way around.
And inhibitory is this. I saw this today. Because in metabolic networks, that means inhibition, right? Which is a little bit confusing. So is there a canonical way? Is there an official way to do it? Anyway, so you say this is excitatory,
Yeah, you can use that also.
Okay, and what do you use for inhibitory?
Either one of the circle or
of the okay. Anyway, just to make sure that we're talking the same language, because for me this is inhibition. Anyway, so basket neurons are inhibitory neurons, GABAergic neurons talking to Purkinje neurons, and we can photocontrol basket neurons and therefore Purkinje neurons, and we can actually photocontrol heartbeat in the leech. This was done with Christen by just adding this compound, right? This compound makes it somehow into the heart. And you see, this is the left and the right ventricle. As you go from green to UV, you make it a little bit more nervous, that animal, or you relax it a little bit just by controlling the firing pattern in a way we really don't understand. This is extremely messy, right? Because these compounds target just about any potassium channel under the sun, all of them, KV1, all of them. The only one they don't hit for reasons we don't understand it is KV32, I believe. But 1,5, 1,3, 1,5 especially, is targeted by this kind of compound.
So how do you get it into
you give this compound with 1% DMSO, you drop it onto the leech.
So it's in all the neurons and
this paper was really tough to publish, as you can imagine, because people say you're crazy, you're putting a tonic blocker of potassium channels. But you know, there's one thing I have learned in pharmacology, that tonic blockers are actually pharmacologically not a bad thing, are relatively easy to work with. Think of beta blockers, right? You tonically block your beta adrenergic receptor with something that is essentially an inverse agonist, right? And how successful it was. There's a Nobel Prize for beta blockers, right? So you don't necessarily kill the animals, apparently, when you tonically block potassium channels wherever they are. This is we have done the panel, the channel panel, as I said, almost every potassium channel is blocked, with the exception of KV32, I believe.
Isn't that odd? Because KV32 is real TEA sensitive.
Pardon me?
KV3 channels are really TEA sensitive normally.
Yeah. We really don't understand that. This compound is, as I showed here, relatively complex, because it has to make its way probably through the site into the potassium channel lumen. I don't think it ever goes into the cytosol and then comes back. There is, like with lidocaine, you know, there's this big debate how lidocaine really finds its target and how it works. There is something going on where not only the TEA sensitivity, the extracellular TEA sensitivity in the outer vestibule, but also the way how it finds the inner vestibule plays a role. And that might be the reason why this is TEA. There is no correlation in the two.
How fast does it turn on and off?
This is a real-time recording. So it's a real-time recording.
How fast
can it? It's not super fast. I agree. This is pretty slow. Yes, that is actually also dependent on the intensity, because that depends on how fast you reach the photostationary state, and the photostationary state is a function of the intensity of light. This is relatively low intensity light. This is not lasers again. I'm pretty sure we can push this a little bit faster. Okay, so we can control, however, albeit we don't fully understand it, the heartbeat of
pacemaker.
Talked with your colleague Herr Bodenschatz years ago about this, and he seemed to be super excited and never heard anything about it. I think there is a possibility to do that, right? This is obvious that this is a way to control arrhythmia, right? If you get the light there. Which is not necessarily impossible. No, it doesn't mean that you have to rip open, you have to make a cut in the subway and then shove in a light
to survive. Survive.
Yeah.
Great if it went the other way.
One advantage we have, I always get this criticism, light doesn't go in more than 300 micron and yada yada and so on, but it turns out we are not imaging, right? We are just turning things on. That means scattering is not a problem for us. And if you're not worried about scattering, then you can get light pretty deeply. I mean, is there a red laser pointer? The green one doesn't work because of hemoglobin, but the red laser point you get through your hand, right? Scattered. So for imaging, useless, but for just turning things on, it's not so much of an issue. But I don't know whether this could compete with the kind of defibrillators you have in the subway. Still, the beauty of light is that you have this enormous, not only spatial, but also temporal control, right? So you can impose a rhythm pretty quickly. And if you are interested in exploring this in cardiac myocytes, I'd be happy to give you this compound. I really think there is some advantage for that. No? Now, I already said that these compounds are messy, and the messiest compound perhaps is, in a way, is this one, quark. We call it quark, quaternary ammonium, azobenzene quaternary ammonium. This actually has two of these quaternary ammonium and sites, and that compound actually does not penetrate the cell membrane anymore. This is not permeant anymore. So you have to either throw this into the pipette, or you have to find a way to get this into the cell, which is perhaps allows for more selectivity. It turns out that quark is very similar to a famous compound I already heard about today, earlier this week, QX314. This is, in essence, this is QX314 with an azobenzene in the middle, right? And as you know, QX314 can be imported into nociceptive neurons through P2X7 receptors and TRPV1 receptors. Now that allows us to actually target quark, which does not normally go into neurons, onto specific cells. As indicated here, this was thought of or conceived by Alexandre Moreau, a postdoc in Rich Kramer's lab. If you add quark, normally it does not permeate the cell membrane because it's doubly charged. But if you have a TRPV1 receptor and you open it with an agonist or a P2X7 receptor, either ATP derivatives or capsaicin does the job, you actually get it in, and then it finds its way into both potassium channels, sodium channels, and even calcium channels can be photoregulated by this compound. And the net effect is, as shown here, the net effect is that you can actually use quark as a photochromic silencer of neural activity. This mostly targets, or the net effect, since it also targets sodium channels effectively, is silencing. As you go between the long form, the transform, at 500 nanometers, we inject increasing currents. You see one action potential, so this, I think, is a sign of quark being an open channel blocker, right, that you have one and then nothing. Whereas if you then bend it at 380 nanometers, it doesn't block the channels anymore, and you see an appropriate response, which you would expect. In essence, this is photoanalgesia, right? That's another instance where we don't really know what to make out of it. Is this useful, that you can turn on and off pain sensation with light? I have a feeling that it could be useful. If you have concrete ideas about this, please talk with me or with Rich Kramer. We are equally interested in this aspect. For me, this, the most interesting aspect this stage is that it also blocks sodium channels and in a targeted fashion, because dorsal root ganglion cells, which express actually P2X7 receptors and TRPV1 receptors, they can be selectively targeted now with quark.
So can you do, are they sensitive enough to changes in light that you can do like a dose response? So for example, if I ramped up the light during activity on the K channel, could I in essence mimic slow and activation or something like
that? There is this possibility. Well, yeah, for slow inactivation, we haven't followed up this, but
It's just you're turning on more and more of the,
which you could
turning off more and more of these.
Which you actually could do with the color. That's the beauty of this azobenzene system, right? That by changing the color gradient, you can ramp it because you change the photostationary states. Right? You can go from 100.0 to 95.5. By going from green to blue, towards violet, you actually get more and more cysts.
A different proportion.
Yeah. That's one functional aspect which has never been used in these compounds, but which I think as a chemist is fascinating. And that's one aspect you will never have with channel rhodopsins. That by sort of moving the color dial, you can determine the amount of current you inject.
Is that really different though than just changing the amplitude of a particular color component?
Yeah, I mean, can't you do it that way? That's what I was asking.
You tell me, right? With intensity, of course, you can also play by just turning more and more channel rhodopsins on by being more intense, right, up to saturation point. That's maybe the reason why it hasn't been used yet. But if you want to stay at a uniform intensity, then you could do this with the color of the light. So in any case, this is photo control of sodium channels. You really have to think about these compounds as photoswitchable versions of lidocaine. I think that's the best way, and of QX314. This is lidocaine. QX314 is just a permanently charged version of lidocaine. So if you...
So why are you using 380 nanometers or 500? Because really 900 would be ideal for... Yeah.
I'm working very hard on photo switches which work in the near infrared. That's a chemical problem. I will show you a solution to this, if you give me a few more minutes. We actually are working on this. We are always using these two wavelengths because this is our parent system. This di-azolated azo-dianiline just has this photophysical property. And they are very photostable and they're easy to make. It's one of the reasons why we've always worked with them. But I am very interested in other photo switches. However, I can tell you, attempts to move away from azobenzenes have so far been very frustrating. And one of the reasons, I think, is because these compounds don't fit switch fast enough anymore. Azobenzenes really switch within a picosecond. And if you start switching within hundreds of picoseconds or so, you get intersystem crossing. And you make single oxygen, and that's death. So you essentially make reactive oxygen species by photo switching, and that's the reason why I love these azobenzenes, because they just don't do that. So how about using these compounds?
The sensitivity of QAP to sodium channels versus the potassium channels is the same as QX340.
It's similar. It's QAP, I seem to remember, is a little bit more active on sodium channels than in potassium channels, but it's not much. It's not orders of magnitude. It's
QX is much more sensitive. It is much more active on sodium channels than potassium channels.
But I don't think it's more than tenfold or so. I forgot. Honestly, I forgot the exact number. Now we did determine that. It is similar to lidocaine and similar to QX. Okay, how about using this in vision? Well, the advantage of these switches now is that you don't have to do any gene transfer, right? There's no viral transfection you need to get the modified cysteine mutant of your compound. And you just add these compounds onto the retina. And we did this actually a while ago. This is another paper under review right now, where AAQ, one of these compounds is called AAQ of these simple photoswitchable TAs. Treatment imparts light sensitivity on RD1 mice. This is an RD1 mouse, which actually is melanopsin -2. So this mouse is really blind, or was blind, as you see from this mouse, the electrode recording, ray recording, dark 380, 500, dark 380, 500. There's just noise on average. And then we add our compound, and it looks like this. We suddenly have these bursts, or these stripes of activity. This is an early recording, still pretty noisy. This is currently investigated together with Russ van Gelder and Rich Kramer, of course. Russ has come up recently with traces like this. These are three retinae. You switch between 380 and 500 nanometers, and you see these beautiful stripes of activity. This is not bad, I've been told. This is a retinal slow wave, so this is actually good that we still see retinal slow waves. That just shows that our chemical is not as invasive as perhaps other systems would be, in particular retinal implants. Right? You just add this chemical onto the retina, or you inject it into the vitreous body. There's nothing else you have to do. And you see these patterns. The disadvantage still is that it's 380-500. That's the disadvantage. But you see this activity, and this also happens at the behavior level. So far, we have pupillary reflexes, which I understand go through the central nervous system and are not triggered on the... These are three different retinae of RD1 mice. And again, this is apparently a retinal slow wave, this smear. So this is not bad, but this is apparently good because it just shows that we are not messing with the native circuitry too much when you see that. So I want to conclude by bringing forth the chemistry again, the power of chemical tuning. I already talked about PTL versus PCL, that you have an electrophile here, as we say in chemistry, in Chemlish, whether you can attach it covalently or not. That it determines whether it's genetically encodable. The photochemical properties of the switch can be tuned. I'll get back to that. And of course, the pharmacology can be tuned, because we can put all kinds of agonists, antagonists. I should have mentioned it's actually very easy to turn a tethered agonist into a tethered antagonist, because you just move the point of attachment a little bit, and then it flips, and the clamshell closes, but it cannot close fully, since this is the foot in the door mechanism of antagonism in glutamate receptors. Right? So by just moving a little bit, you can actually turn an agonist into an antagonist rather easily, for what it's worth. And just a little photophysics of azobenzenes. So regular azobenzenes switch at this wavelength, which you have seen. The thermal turnoff is very slow. The thermal turnoff takes 15 minutes. So that's neurobiologically irrelevant. If you substitute them with an electron donating substituent, you actually redshift the system, so the cis azobenzene content is maximized already in the visible region of the spectrum. However, the thermal isomerization is still slow, and there are gratifyingly these so-called pseudo-steel beings. These are so-called push-pull azobenzenes, which have one electron withdrawing, one electron donating substituent, and they are greatly redshifted, so they really work fully in the visible region, and they turn themselves off within milliseconds to 10 to milliseconds. We have not been able to push them to microseconds yet, which I would like to do, but that now means you don't have to toggle between two different wavelengths. Forget about this. We've made the appropriate compound. This is a push-pull system. This actually has the maximum cis content at 472 nanometers, so in the blue-greenish region, and it turns itself off within milliseconds, and that's the effect on the retina. We switch between dark and green, dark and green, dark and green, dark and green, we see these stripes. There's no toggling between two different wavelengths, and I already can tell you that this works with white light, so with ambient light, this works as well. Not intensity-wise, in this case, you still have to, it will be bright daylight we need to use, but spectral-wise, it actually works quite beautifully in this multi-electrode array recording. So let me conclude a little bit philosophically. Admittedly, these systems are pretty coarse still, right? I mean, but you know, give us a couple of billion years and we'll catch up with channel adopsins. And we've just added a little functional sort of module onto a highly evolved system. It took hundreds, if not thousands of years to come up with these highly evolved liners, ships, and we have just added a new functional property which allows this, for instance, to go backwards. So it's early in the game, but new function, and I hope that this will be useful. We're certainly, where do I have this slide? We're certainly not running out of targets to apply this to. I should have mentioned that we already have some pretty good experiences now with type A GPCRs, beta-adrenergic receptors, dopamine receptors. That looks actually pretty good at this stage. All of which is aided by this sudden flood of crystal structures. I mean, the work of Ray Stevens is for the design of our molecules absolutely crucial, I would say. So thanks a lot for paying attention to me. I have repeatedly said that I'm really just the spokesperson for a rather large collaboration here. The major players, Uri, Rich, Eric Bayer, and John Flannery. But as a chemist, I'm sitting in the center of the spider web, so to speak, right? And we discuss a lot. I would have never done this by myself as a chemist, or we still would measure around oxynobus oocytes and try to investigate single molecule azobenzene switching, but these gentlemen have pushed us to put this into animals, not only tissues, but also cells, also animals, within a couple of years. Thanks a lot.
So, can this azobenzene system be used as a reporter rather than to manipulate? So could you make some kind of sensor of ligands? Or?
You could, but you know, I have deliberately stayed away from imaging or recording because the world of chemists who work on imaging or recording is huge. We use light to read out information is huge, and the number of chemists who use light to put in information, or maybe one day magnetic fields to put in information. I'm really fascinated by the idea that we could trigger an ion channel with magnetic fields, because then you can go really deep in, and you can, with gradients, you can localize pretty well at this point already. So you can probably target a nucleus in the central nervous system. That is relatively a small number. Where these photo switches might play a huge role, and we actually have to admit we are thinking a little bit about this, is in super resolution imaging. Because if you could turn off fluorescence in a deterministic way, as opposed to a stochastic way, as in storm, you could work with much lower intensities, and you could work with, this would have a huge impact. But it turns out that Stefan Hell and half of the world is already thinking about this as well, and they've thrown cohorts of chemists onto that issue, whether you can turn on off fluorescence with photo switches. Which is a difficult problem because fluorescence is the enemy of switching, right? I mean, the molecule gets rid of it by emitting a photon instead of switching. So you have to really play rather sophisticatedly with the spectra to make this happen. I don't think it's going to be that easy.
So, you have to.
In the retinal case, you said that you should simply push these modified molecules in the retina and you see these effects. So are these molecules in any way toxic or?
So far, no. I mean, not as far as you can tell. I'm surprised how little toxic they are. Azobenzenes, if you Google azobenzene toxicity, you get 100,000 Wikipedia hits because azobenzenes have a bad rap sheet on that. The reason being that azobenzenes were used as food colorants for decades, right? And then people started worrying whether they are that healthy and threw them into Ames tests, and they found many which are seriously toxic, right? Butter yellow, for instance, which was used to dye butter for decades, is actually quite toxic. On the other hand, I can tell you that many are still used. I don't know how many of you are guilty of eating Cheetos every now and then. The lovely orange color of Cheetos is an azobenzene, right? Which is another reason not to eat that crap. but it's not that they are necessarily toxic just because they're azobenzenes, right? It depends on the electronic nature. What they are not, and this is really the most important point, is they're not phototoxic. They've switched so fast that they're not phototoxic. They don't bleach and they don't mix any oxygen, as far as we can tell, the ones we've used so far. There are toxicity issues with these amphiphilic compounds because they might disrupt the membrane. But I think this has to be evaluated on a case-to-case basis. I mean, we routinely inject azobenzenes into the vitreous body of animals. And even with the covalently attached ones, we don't see the immune response, which was my major concern. The eye, of course, is somewhat immunoprivileged, right? So you don't have the, if you put this in systemically, it will probably trigger massive antibody-based immune responses. But in the eye, it doesn't seem.
And have you done any primate experiments?
It's coming. Russ is on it. Nothing to write home about yet, and nothing to disclose. But the non-covalent attached ones are at this stage already. And there, the behavioral essays will become more relevant, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the concentrations we need to use of these compounds are fairly high, but then again, the eye is not such a large compartment, right? And it does not get that easily, I mean, it does do a first pass, from whatever. There's a whole world on this. There's also a huge body of literature on slow release of compounds in the eye. It turns out that Lucentis, the antibody, is delivered with a slow release patch. And there are polymers which gradually release charged compounds that can be deposited in the eye.
Yeah, I just missed it, but how do you target specific cell types?
By way of a specific transfection. If you with a Gal4 line, if you can get in, this is what Herwig Bayer did with the fish, right? If you get this into the Kohlmark II neuron, then you will only target that cell because this is actually a concern I often get as well. Aren't there other cysteines on the surface where this thing can attach to? Yes, there may be some. I actually don't think it's going to be that many because non-oxidized surface cysteines on the surface of cells are very rare. They're usually disulfides or they're not exposed, they're hidden. Well, they are oxidized to sulfonic acids. And, you know, it might happen that every now and then an azobenzene is dangling off a protein which it doesn't belong to, but the likelihood that you trigger something there is extremely small. Cells are very tolerant towards garbage dangling on the surface, as we know from Kerlin-Vertosi's work, for instance. Right? And then the third answer to the question is we do actually affinity labeling. So we first non-covalently bind by way of the glutamate or the ammonium head group, and then the electrophile looks for the cysteine. And if the azobenzene is in the right form, then this bioconjugation will be very fast. If it's in the stretched form and doesn't have the right distance, it will be very slow. So from these experiments, we know that they actually are affinity labeled, meaning that we're concentrating things up where they belong and where they should go.
And how long do they last? Like in the retina, in the leech, in the
zebra? In the case of the zebrafish, several days, up to a week, before we have to reapply the compound, so a couple of days. In the retina, I would say up to a day or more before we have to reapply. This is why we're thinking about slow release patches, because you cannot inject every other day a compound into the vitreous body. If you seriously think about therapy, right, which we actually do at this point. So it does last fairly long. As you know, lidocaine and versions of lidocaine are very long-lasting. because they actually distribute themselves into the membrane, they partition into the membrane, and then they stay there. And it's actually a challenge to find to come up with a short duration analgesic. That's a problem, right? Because these things like to stick in the membrane and then you can get them out. And for us, this is a benefit, of course. So we're not talking of minutes or hours, we're really talking of days for the non-covalent attachments. I forgot. You have to ask Bill Christen. Oh, I actually don't think he ever told me how many days later they were still sensitive.